We're talking about the process of getting Harriet Tubman on the $20 bill. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. During a recent hearing before the House Financial Services Committee, Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin said the redesign of the $20 bill to feature abolitionist leader Harriet Tubman had been delayed with security issues.
It is my responsibility now to focus on what is the issue of counterfeiting and the security features. The ultimate decision on the redesign will most likely be another secretary's down the road.
But this plan to make an anti-slavery crusader the face of one of the most popular bills in the world suggests a deeper struggle that we should talk about. How important is it to you to have women on currency? What questions do you have about the process of changing what's on our money? We're at 800-642-1234. Barbara Ortiz Howard is the founder of Women on 20s. That's a campaign to get a woman on the $20 bill. Barbara, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
So as we just heard there, Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin talking about the delay, can you start by explaining how we got to this point of getting so close to having Harriet Tubman on the $20 bill?
Yes, we were very close because after our campaign, which we started 4 years ago in 2015, in the public eye, a year later, the then Secretary Jacob Lew announced that we would have three bills featuring women, and most importantly to us, on the $20 bill that Harriet Tubman would be on it. And that grew out of a very public grassroots campaign to have a woman on the $20 bill. And in the 10 weeks of our voting, where we had over 600,000 votes, Harriet Tubman emerged as the winner. We presented that to the Treasury. And they said, well, we have plans to put women on money, but it's going to be the $10 bill. And that delayed our whole process for a year. Unfortunately, we lost time there because had they just gone with that sentiment earlier on, then maybe we'd be a little further along in the process right now.
And so when you did this contest, if you will, this crowdsourcing of who should be on the currency, you had a number of women as, up against Harriet Tubman. And as choices, who did you put out there?
Well, we actually started with over 100 women that could potentially be candidate for the $20 bill. And we went to, we had what we called our caucus period, and we went out to professors, authors, people on the area of women's rights and studies, and we asked them to evaluate the candidates that we had on a scale of whether what their contribution meant to society and the difficulty they had, and we were able to whittle that down from 100 to 60 to 30, and then we presented the public with 15 names, a number of suffragists, including the more well-known names of Susan B. Anthony and Elizabeth Cady Stanton, Alice Paul, Sojourner Truth, Lucretia Mott. You know, those are the well-known names, but certainly there were many more, and so they were part of it. We had Frances Perkins, we had Rachel Carson, Clara Barton, and then actually, out of that first round of voting, our primary phase, four women emerged: Eleanor Roosevelt, Rosa Parks, Harriet Tubman, and Wilma Mankiller, who was the chief, the first woman chief of the Cherokee Nation. So she was included in our final four, what we call the final four, because it was March, Women's History Month, March Madness. So we had our final four, and the public then voted again and chose Harriet Tubman.
We're talking about putting Harriet Tubman on the $20 bill. Barbara Ortiz Howard is the founder of that campaign called Women on 20s. You can join in, 800-642-1234. Are you in support of changing who's on the $20 bill? And if so, how soon would you like to see this change go into effect? You can call in, email ideas at WPR.org. Barbara, during his presidential campaign, President Trump said he did not support putting Harriet Tubman on the 20. And here's a clip of then-candidate Trump speaking about the issue during an appearance on the Today Show.
I think Harriet Tubman is fantastic. I would love to leave Andrew Jackson and see if we can maybe come up with another denomination. Maybe we do the $2 bill or we do another bill. I don't like seeing it. Yes, I think it's pure political correctness.
So what do you make of this notion, pure political correctness?
Yeah, in that clip, you hear him ramping up. You know, first she's fantastic, and maybe another, and then he went and flipped and went into the, it's pure political correctness. It's actually the correct thing, the right thing to do, the morally right thing to do, to recognize someone for the great achievements and the contributions to this country. Yesterday was 156 years that Harriet Tubman sacrificed her life to lead our Union troops to South Carolina to free over 800 slaves in the Combahee River Ferry release. And that was really incredible. And to be able to lead an expedition like that, she was the first woman to ever do such a thing. So recognizing her is the appropriate thing to do. It's not anything like political correctness.
There's been a lot of reaction to this delay, but you say on your website that even under the most optimistic timetable that was set out by the Obama administration, the bill itself never was expected to be in our hands before 2026. Why does it take so long?
It is quite a question as to why they take so long relative to other countries. We have a great responsibility, of course, to make sure that our money is not counterfeited. We are the most used currency in the world. Two-thirds of our cash is used outside of the United States. So there's quite a bit of precaution taken. That being said, we're just woefully slow. It took 14 years for the $100 bill with that blue ribbon to go from being decided to be done to coming out. It would take a long time. They probably should retool their whole manufacturing in the BEP, the Bureau of Engraving and Printing in Washington and Dallas, to accommodate new bills, new kinds of printing. And then we also have to create a bill which is more friendly for visually challenged people. Like, we were supposed to have a tactile feature. Now they're giving out readers, you know, apps and readers, so people can who have difficulty seeing our money, because all our money is the same size, the same feel practically. It's very difficult to distinguish if you have a visual challenge.
We're talking about the news that the Harriet Tubman $20 bill would be delayed. Looking closer at what the process looks like for getting women on hard currency, Barbara Ortiz Howard started a campaign to get women on the $20 bill. It's called Women on 20s. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you support changing who's on the $20 bill? And if so, how soon would you like to see this change go into effect? If not, do you think this is a case of political correctness, as President Trump has suggested? Call in. You can also tweet us, WPR Mornings. We'll get back to this conversation in a minute here on the Ideas Network. We're talking about the redesigned $20 bill and the delay in getting Harriet Tubman on it. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. The bill bearing her face was supposed to debut next year. It's been delayed nearly a decade. And a grassroots campaign called Women on 20s inspired federal legislation on this. Harriet Tubman came out as the front runner to replace President Andrew Jackson after more than 600,000 people cast ballots. Is it important to you that women be represented on currency? Does it matter if it's a paper bill or a coin? What other American women would you like to see on our bills? Join in at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Barbara Ortiz Howard is founder of the Women on 20s campaign, and she stays with us. Let's go to the phones now with Andrew joining us from Heartland. Hi, Andrew.
Hey, how are you?
Good. What's on your mind about the 20s?
My particular outlook on it is that whether it's taking Alexander Hamilton off the $10 bill or whoever's on the $20 bill, it's really a non-issue because we were meant to have hard assets, so, you know, gold and silver as our currency or as money, and we've been tricked into taking paper money that can be printed at will and debased. And I think whoever is on the paper money is kind of a non-issue because the bigger issue is being able to be printed out of our value on what our purchasing power is. So that's the bigger issue to me.
Andrew, thanks for the call. Barbara, what do you make of that?
Well, it's interesting. We're using more cash now than ever. I thought that may have been where Andrew was going. We thought we're not going to be using it. We'll be using our debit cards and we'll be swiping and using apps and things to pay. But cash is actually, the use of it is on the rise. And for whatever reason, people believe in the system, so it works for now. Who didn't believe in the system was Andrew Jackson. He did not believe in paper money. And it's ironic that he is on it for that particular reason. So that's a system we kind of bought into at this time. And the prevalence and the use of the $20 bill, which is used four or five times as much as the $10 bill or any other bill, it's very important to see someone who represents the other part of our population, the other 51% of our population, a woman, and because we're not seen in our cultural landscape. And that was one of the critical things, is that women are absent in our parks and in the manner of statues, or we don't have stadiums named after us and bridges. Oh, there are a few bridges in Philadelphia. Here there are some bridges. But in general, women are not seen in our cultural landscape and not held up. So we need those models. It's reinforcing the potential of what women could do.
Barbara, what about bill security? Because the 20 is the most counterfeited bill out there, and we heard Secretary Mnuchin cite new counterfeiting measures as his priority. What do we know there?
Right. So they claim that the $10 bill is the bill that is most at risk. So that's the next bill to be redesigned, which is what is putting off the redesign of the 20. The thing is that they use a different method of determining what is at risk, and it's not the value of the money or the volume. It's more like the percentage. So if you had 110 dollar bills and 10 of them were bad, that's 10%. But if you have, let's say, $420 bills out there, and 20 of them are bad, that's worth $400, but it's only 5%. So, but they're not going by that. They're going by the percentage versus the number of bills in circulation, which we have always thought was faulty. They told us that back in 2015, that no, the $10 bill has to be changed next. Then they felt that the $5 had to be changed again. And now we're really surprised because the secretary is saying, let's change the $50 bill. And we're like, what's wrong with the $50 bill now? So for us, the $20 bill is at risk. And why don't we change all of them at once? Why do we have to change them in slow succession?
Well, women have been on currency before in the U.S., and we should point that out. Most recently, Susan B. Anthony, Sacagawea have appeared on gold dollar coins. Do you see a difference in appearing on a bill versus a coin?
Sure. The Susan B. Anthony coin is no longer minted. It was a resounding failure. It was done in a way which folks didn't quite know what was going on with it. It resembled a quarter, and so people weren't using it. The gold coin, which then started to have Sacagawea on it, now has all the vice presidents on it, so it's hardly her coin. And again, it's not been widely used. And a bill, though, when it comes out, you know, the most common bill to come out is out of your ATM is your $20 bill, and is the most widely circulated. So having something that's that prevalent and predominant in your everyday experience has meaning on a conscious and unconscious level.
So there has been some legislation in front of Congress that could speed up this timeline here. Can you explain what we're seeing on Capitol Hill about this?
Yes, that's been an area where we had some concern at first. Why bring, you know, when we were figuring out our campaign, do we bring it to Congress? Do we petition the federal government? And the Secretary of the Treasury does have the last say on which design and who's going to be on our bills. And in 1929, the then Secretary of Treasury, Andrew Mellon, made the decision to take Grover Cleveland off the 20 and put Andrew Jackson on it. And, you know, since it seems like a fairly straightforward and simple process, we thought we should go to the executive branch and not have it kick around in Congress for a longer period of time, because we wanted this to happen in a short period of time. By 2020, let's see that design to honor the centennial 19th Amendment, where white women got the right to vote. So we thought, well, you know, maybe not everyone's gotten the right to vote, but let's at least recognize it was a step. And what do we have to do to continue in that way to make sure that everyone has equal rights? But we want to now support the Congress that has said, well, you know, maybe we need a Harriet Tubman tribute bill. So in the House, there's H.R. 1083, and Senator Shaheen from New Hampshire has also introduced a bill in the Senate. I believe in the House it's a little further under consideration, which I believe may have actually been something which influenced Representative Presley last week to start that line of questioning with Steven Mnuchin, because she's on that finance committee that's reviewing that bill, 1083, mm-hmm. to have the Harriet Tubman tribute bill. And it's not the first time Congress has actually had some say in it. They, you know, In God We Trust was something that Congress put forward, as well as making a rule that the $1 bill could not be changed. You cannot take George off the bill. It's something that Congress had made law. Of course, that laws are often changed. If you wanted George off, which that would be probably completely sacrilegious here at this point, but
Barbara,
it were to change.
Yeah, Barbara, some might say this is just money, and there are a whole lot of bigger issues facing women in America right now. How would you respond to that?
Absolutely. There are so many issues facing women, facing humanity. Our future does seem to be facing tremendous challenge at this time. However, recognizing those who had that vision, who in the similar situation that we find ourselves in now, had a vision of how we could move forward, can be inspirational. And we need inspiration right now, along with concrete things that change. And so it's just important to have something to look to inspire us.
Barbara, thank you so much for joining us.
I'm so happy to have had this time. Thank you.
Barbara Ortiz Howard is founder of Women on 20s. That's a campaign to get a woman on the $20 bill. And we've been talking about the delay in getting Harriet Tubman on the $20 bill. This would mark the first time a black woman would be on U.S. currency. Coming up, more than 14 million millennials live with one or both parents. We'll look at the family dynamics when a young adult moves back home. Let's talk about it after a news update here on the Ideas Network. We're talking about moving back home as a young adult. It's The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. It's college graduation season. Students graduate, they get handed their diploma, and then many move back home. According to census data, more than a third of young adults between the ages of 18 and 34 lived at home in 2015. That's up from 26% in 2005. Parents, what issues did you run into? Was it around laundry or food, drinking or smoking? How did you work through it? Young adults, are you back in your childhood bedroom? What is your experience returning home? We're at 800-642-1234 to join in. Alexandra Solomon is a clinical psychologist at the Family Institute at Northwestern University, where she's a clinical assistant professor in the Department of Psychology. Alexandra, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thank you so much for having me on, Kate.
Well, so when students go off to college, there are tears often, and when they come back, they might feel like crying too. What do you think is one of the most common issues families run into when students return home for the summer or perhaps after graduating as young adults?
Sure. Well, I think that the most important thing to keep in mind is that change is hard for all of us, even if it's change that is wanted, that's anticipated, and that has lots of blessings, which certainly, you know, a family reuniting like this, there are lots of blessings, but change is difficult and it's stressful. And so just, it's really important for everyone to try to avoid these conversations that are about good, bad, right, wrong, and just kind of hold on to the fact that this is complicated. We're in a new chapter of our family's story. So everyone needs to tread a bit lightly.
So when you say issues of good, bad, right, wrong, what are some of those perhaps black and white issues?
Yeah, I think that one of the challenges that parents go through during this launching your kids' journey, which is a journey because it doesn't happen all at once. And like you're saying, about a third of college students will head back home even after graduation. Parents are really adjusting from being sort of this top-down family leader to being a bit more on the sidelines and having to take more of a collaborative approach and having to know when to listen more than talk.
So when the student goes away, what happens while they're away? How do they grow and mature and change? And can parents really see that maturity from a distance?
Mm-hmm. It may be hard to see, and it may not become clear until that college student returns home, which is why we're saying that the return home, whether it's for the summer or post-graduation, that it's a process. So it may not be evident on day one, because especially on day one, college students probably come home very, very exhausted and may need to just have a few days of really letting down. I think it can be easy for parents to forget how intense a college academic year is, especially finals. So the first glimpse they may have of their college student is probably a pretty raggedy glimpse. And it may take a while for the college college student's better, more mature self to emerge, but it's in there somewhere under the under the haze of exhaustion and some sadness. I think it may be hard for parents too that this they get their college student home and they, the parent, are so excited to connect and debrief and download, and their college student may be beyond exhausted, but also sad. You know, we talk about homesickness, but I think there's also, it's really quite common to have college sickness, you know, to really miss the friendships they've established. And so parents can, I think, struggle a bit to not take that so personally.
A parent might be thinking, well, my child is now an adult living under my roof for free, and that is a privilege. So how do we negotiate that area, you know, that argument that they're here and living expense-free, you know, for the summer or perhaps after college?
Right. I really like the idea of parents and college students or young adults just sitting down face to face and really looking together at what expectations are, and to have that conversation very much from like a shoulder to shoulder position. Like, we're going to look together at what everyone needs in order to make this living situation best for all involved. I like that much more than a parent saying to the kid, this is the line, like this, like we are telling you how it's going to be. I don't know that we need to do quite that same top-down parenting. I think we can get to the same end goal from a different space, which is more collaborative and more like, okay, so let's figure out how to make this work. What do you need from us? And here's what we need from you. And I think from that collaborative space, parents can say, we really need you to be contributing in some way to whatever it is, you know, groceries or housework or expectations to drive, you know, younger siblings around or whatever it is. But I think that that conversation really can happen from how do we make this best for all of us?
We're talking with Alexandra Solomon. She's a licensed clinical psychologist at the Family Institute at Northwestern University. Parents, how did your young adults' newfound independence change the way they interacted with you? Were you initially upset about it, but found a way to accept the fact that you can't keep parenting them like you did in high school? Join in this conversation at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Alexandra, students that went away to college have also had the chance to develop themselves personally, figure out who they are outside of their relationship to their immediate family. How can these personality changes perhaps drive a wedge between these young adults and their parents?
Yeah, that certainly can happen. And I think what's helpful is for parents to prepare for that, to know that they are, that this is a time of massive kind of reworking and expansion, and that that's really normal. And so they should not expect, you know, the high schooler that they launched to be what comes home, what walks in the door, and that there probably are going to be some shifts. College is a time of really questioning the underpinnings of what you've been taught to believe, especially if a college student is going from, let's say, a relatively small kind of homogenous community into a really big, diverse community where they have been presented with new ideas, new ways of looking at the world. And so it's incumbent upon the college student to come home and talk about what they've learned in a way that parents can hear, right? College students bear a responsibility to kind of talk about what they've learned and how they've grown in ways that really invite their parents in, rather than kind of like finger wagging or blaming or shaming. And it's helpful for parents to, rather than say like, you've changed in a way that is derogatory, to say, wow, like, okay, I'm with you, but this is a lot, you know, and just to expect it and to resist the urge to be critical. And perhaps then behind closed doors with your spouse, say, oh my gosh, who is this person that's just come home? reserve that conversation for behind closed doors.
What about a student who comes home who perhaps is exhibiting signs of depression or anxiety? What should we be looking for there?
Yeah. So What we're looking for there would be struggles to kind of stay out of bed that are above and beyond what I'm saying about kind of normative exhaustion. If they, you know, college students, I will say that what, you know, I've been teaching at Northwestern University for getting close to 20 years, and I have seen a really big shift around mental health awareness on college campuses and students' awareness about their own mental health. So I think we are doing a really nice job of helping students understand their struggles, identify their struggles. And so students may be able to come home and say to their parents, you know, I'm not doing so well. And then parents and students ought to be working together to help their child get some therapy over the summer and see if they can kind of get restabilized before the school year starts again.
What kind of destabilization happened during that year in college, or what is happening? Should the parent be probing what's going on campus to figure out where this anxiety or perhaps depression is coming from?
Mm-hmm. I think it's really great to open up conversations about, tell me about your school year, what's been challenging for you. And I think one of the things, you know, that happens certainly early in college can be a reckoning for college, for students, you know, who've come from sort of top of their class in their high schools, and they get to a college campus and they realize that everybody on that college campus has been top of their class. And so they may have felt like a rather big fish in a small pond in high school, and then they get to college and there can be deep questions of self-worth and sort of competitiveness and where do I fit in, and then just lots of questions around identity of what do I want to, you know, be when I grow up and where do I want to contribute. And I think parents can be really affirming around the idea that this is a process. Parents can be validating about this makes sense, this is a hard time. And parents, I think, can check in, especially, you know, another way that this may play out is around substance use. And sometimes parents will be aware that their kids are using substances. And I think that's a great, if there's concern, I think that's a great question to bring to a therapist and have some eyes on that college student and understand, is this kind of normative experimentation with substance use, or is this really substance use that is becoming an addiction or is masking an underlying anxiety or depressive disorder?
There is a growing number of young adults who live in their parents' home. According to census data from recent years, it's the most popular living arrangement for young adults. Clinical psychologist Alexandra Solomon is our guide as we talk about the relationship dynamics that come out of this living situation. You can join in with your experience, your questions, 800-642-1234. Students, what was the hardest part about moving back home after college or even for the summer? Was it by choice? Are you struggling or thriving? You can call in, email ideas@WPR.org. We'll get back to this in just a minute here on the Ideas Network. More young adults are still living at home than was the case a generation ago. We're talking about that arrangement when a young adult moves back home. It's The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. According to Pew, a record 64 million Americans are now living in multi-generational households. And we're talking about what home life is like. What are the struggles and drawbacks? What are the good things that have come out of this living arrangement? Join in with your questions, your experiences at 800-642-1234. There's a line for you. Northwestern State University clinical psychologist Alexandra Solomon stays with us. Alexandra, you were talking there a little bit about substance abuse, and young adults who return home from college might also have developed a different relationship to alcohol. What are some healthy and reasonable restrictions, perhaps, that parents can set in the home?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think especially if there are younger siblings in the home still, I think it's really appropriate for parents to just establish a healthy boundary and say, this is, you know, we need to work with you on this, and this is nothing we want your younger brother or younger sister to see, and to just make that expectation really clear, and obviously to be really clear with the college student about, you know, not drinking and driving and making those kinds of safe choices, because it's different. You know, to drink on a college campus is different around, you know, oftentimes college students don't even have cars, so it wouldn't be even be a choice. So a conversation that's a reminder about, hey, this is different, and what's your plan if you are going to drink, and just renegotiating that conversation, which families may not have talked about, you know, certainly in high school, but it's a good time to revisit that and for parents to be clear what the boundary is.
How much should parents expect their young adult to adhere to a curfew, or is curfew out the window?
Well, I think the reframe is around we're sharing space, and what do we all need in order to share this space together? And the red flag that we're looking for is resentment, the kind of building up of resentment. And so I think parents can say, listen, we're aware that this is going to go better from our end if we just have a sense of where you're going to be and having you check in with us. And we know that when you're on campus, you're not used to having to check in with people, but it really is a matter of courtesy, and it's a matter of just kind of keeping the space between us, a space of fondness and love and friendliness. And it's going to go a lot better from our end if we have a sense of where you are and when we can expect you home again. So I think that's a nice way of reframing it, not as a power and control and curfew kind of a matter, but more like we're all in this together, and here's what we all need in order to make it work.
So let's go a little bit back to rent. Is there a right way to charge rent? Should parents wait until their young adult has had a chance to get a job, or should they set a deadline so that the young adult knows when it, you know, to start sending out resumes?
I think definitely having having a deadline or a checkpoint, you know, maybe parents, I think it's, again, parents need to track what they need in order to prevent that buildup of resentment. So their parents are walking this line between coming down so hard that it creates tension and hostility versus saying nothing, and then they end up feeling like a doormat and feeling resentful from that space. So parents are trying to kind of walk a middle line there. And so it may be like, listen, we understand you just got home, you're exhausted, you need some time, but July 1st, the expectation is that you will, whatever, you know, have resumes out. So I think parents can say, by this point, we'll need to have a conversation, or by this point, we expect, or by September 1st, we're going to be working on a rent agreement. I think there can be just these sort of check-in dates. And again, the more it can be that everyone has their eye on the same goal, whether that's that the kid is, you know, living in their own apartment within 6 months or a year, like whatever the kind of grander vision is, I think that makes it easier to put those mini deadlines in place.
Alexandra, what is the biggest obstacle in the way of parents and their children making progress in their relationship when things are contentious? And, you know, what is getting in the way of parents and their young adults growing a better relationship?
I think a lot of times it's resistance to change. I think it is sometimes the younger generation having a hard time seeing their parents as human beings, imperfect human beings. In the classes that I teach, both my undergraduate students and my graduate students, both of my classes, which are relationship development classes, I have them do an assignment where they have conversation about love, about relationship, about understanding their family's story. In both of my classes, that's a vital assignment. And what my students say more than anything else is how important it was for them to talk to their parents as people rather than just as parents, which is a sort of a far narrower definition of humanity, right? Than seeing their parents as sort of these full people who have a past, a present, and a future. And so if the younger generation can't do that and they are locked into the view they had of their parent in high school, then the younger generation is going to be sort of ready for a power struggle, ready to fight, ready to perceive their parents as whatever, you know, rigid or not understanding. So that's, I think the younger generation needs to update their view of who their parents are. And then for parents, just that letting go of control. And sometimes for parents, it is really being able to understand the kid they have versus the kid that they thought they would have or the kid they think they should have. And so really meeting their kid on their kid's terms and dropping the story of how they thought it should have gone, which is the biggest challenge of parenting from the time our babies are born all the way through, is continuing to get to know our kids as they are versus seeing them through the lens of our own expectation or our own projection or our own shortcomings or foibles.
Well, let's say a college student's old bedroom has been repurposed into a study or perhaps claimed by a younger sibling. How can that territory, how can that affect the way that young adult feels?
Yeah, I think that then the student probably would feel like, okay, I'm really not being welcomed back home. And it may be that the family, you know, if a family really, if their deep truth is we cannot have you back in our home, that's a very different kind of a conversation. And it may be a great time to bring in a family therapist. So that is, you know, when we think about the large field of therapy, there are some therapists called marriage and family therapists who specialize in working with people in their system, in their context. And so it's a great time for family therapy. So this would be the parents and the college students going to a therapist together and having this conversation there about, here's why we made the choice to get rid of your bedroom. Here's why we can't have you come back home. Here's what we can do. Here's what we can't do. And working with a therapist on it.
So speaking of siblings, though, how do relationships with siblings change when a college student comes home or a college student is away, a young adult is away for quite a while?
Mm-hmm. Well, if the college, right, if the younger ones haven't launched yet, I think it can be, I think it's really incumbent upon the older sibling to be kind, to be patient. I think that there can be a sense of, you know, once you've moved away from the house, the world looks a bit different. The family household looks a bit different. And it's incumbent upon the older sibling to be gentle, to be patient, you know, maybe a bit of a less is more, not needing to kind of tell the younger sibling, you know, all of what they're doing wrong, and to practice some patience and some humility, I would say.
Alexandra, we've been talking about the more contentious issues that have come up when young adults come home, but what are the more positive things? What is the positive side to this? Do we see young adults more appreciative of their parents, perhaps?
Well, that's certainly what I see so much with the college students and the graduate students that I work with, is a lot of gratitude for everything that parents have done in order to make college possible. I mean, this is what I would want college students to really be thinking about, are the sacrifices that the parents have made to make college possible. And sometimes what that does is trigger within the younger generation a sense of guilt, feeling guilty that their parents worked so hard to make this possible, feeling guilty that college was possible for them and it hadn't been possible for their parents. And with that sense of guilt, I always want my college students to be shifting it from guilt to gratitude, feeling grateful. I think that's a really big difference. When we feel guilty, when we feel ashamed, we tend to pull back and shut down, and sometimes we get passive aggressive. And so to shift from, I feel guilty for all that my parents have done for me and the fact I'll never be able to repay it, to I feel grateful. And what might you do and say from that space of gratitude instead?
Alexandra, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me on.
Alexandra Solomon is a licensed clinical psychologist at Northwestern University, author of Loving Bravely. This is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to the Ideas Network.